You are listening to the Bigfoot Information Project podcast, episode 6, Area X. It's dark. Very dark. So dark that my arm extended before me and clutching Daryl Collier's backpack from behind is illuminated only by the feeble starlight in the moonless sky peeking through the forest canopy above my head, and it glows the palest ghostly white. I can barely see it before me. Daryl is wearing head-mounted third-generation night vision and sees the road before us and the forest around us washed in eerie green, while I am essentially blind and surrounded by inky darkness. He is leading me at a moderate clip along a forest road cut deep in the Ouachita Mountains. With each step, I run the risk of treading on a rock or branch which could trip me, twist my ankle, or worse. Our destination is a remote call blasting station higher up the mountainside overlooking the valley, designated by the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy as Area X. Just like David Byrne, I have to ask myself, how did I get here? Minutes before, I was sitting in the middle of the forest road near where it's crossed by a dry creek, along with researchers Monica Rollins and Chris Buttonbaugh. We were monitoring the call blasting from above and listening for return calls, or any other activity they might incite from the forest around us. From up the road, we saw the bobbing red headlight of Daryl approaching our position. The call blasting team's radio wasn't working, so he decided to hike up there and wanted me to come along. We stop by the truck to retrieve the night vision unit, and then he tells me to kill my light. I do so, and am instantly plunged into total blackness. In BIPcast 5, I introduced you to the TBRC's Operation Forest Vigil. By placing motion and heat-sensing camera traps in remote locations with a history of reported Sasquatch activity, they hope to provide clear documentation of an animal conventional wisdom says doesn't exist. Last time, I took you to the location they call Area Y in the low wetlands of the Big Thicket region of Texas. Now I'm several hundred miles to the north in Area X, an altogether different environment. Nestled in a long rocky canyon in the vast forests of the Ouachita Range is a relatively tiny plot of private land upon which has been built a number of small rustic cabins by the family who owns the property. They have invited members of the TBRC here to conduct investigations for nearly a decade, and in the past 2 years, to install a series of cameras for Forest Vigil. The Ouachitas are the only major mountain range between the Appalachians and the Rockies. Located in southeastern Oklahoma and west-central Arkansas, the Ouachitas are an unusually aligned east-to-west range and were formed by the tectonic collision of North and South America. Their ancient rounded peaks are the exposed heart of a once craggy profile, and their folded and twisted shape looks on a topo map like pulled saltwater taffy. Vertical shelves of sedimentary rock jut from the earth all around, and neat geometric blocks cleave from their edges. This area is home to bear, cougar, deer, and over a dozen species of plants found nowhere else on Earth. The forest down in the valley is mostly comprised of hardwoods like oak, while higher up on the mountainsides, upland and loblolly pines take over. The ground, as you walk across it, is alive with hopping crickets, grasshoppers, toads, and crawling lizards and spiders, including the dreaded brown recluse whose necrotic venom can eat away a victim's flesh. Poison ivy and thorny vines are abundant, as are ticks and venomous snakes like the cottonmouth and the timber rattler. As in BIPcast 5, the main purpose of this trip is the maintenance of camera traps. However, Area X also offers terrific opportunity to conduct night operations. The region around X is even less densely populated than Y, and, as I mentioned, it sits entirely on private property. The TBRC has free rein to position themselves around the area and call blast into the wee hours of the morning without fear of disturbing, or being disturbed by, others. Since many believe Bigfoot to be a nocturnal or crepuscular animal, that is, active near dusk and dawn, nighttime is prime time if you're looking for an experience of the squatchy kind. And that brings us back to our story. Daryl and I have begun our ascent of the mountain and have switched back to red headlights. The condition of the road and its incline makes it impossible for him to safely lead me any longer. For the first time in this area, the TBRC are using various primate calls in an attempt to elicit some kind of response from the local wildlife. About halfway up the mountain, and immediately after the team above us broadcasts the sounds of agitated chimps, we hear a tremendous crash below us in the direction of Monica and Chris. It sounds like a huge boulder has been heaved on a dry creek bed. A quick radio check confirms the sound was heard clearly by them and was located somewhere between our two positions. What caused that sound? Was it some kind of display in response to the calls? Since we have neither heard nor seen any other signs of activity up to this point, and since rocks, of course, do fall down mountainsides, it's impossible to say what triggered it. However, its timing, immediately following the call, is an interesting coincidence, and it was not the sound of rock tumbling down a slope. It sounded like a large rock landing with great force atop other rocks and bouncing once or twice. We quickly continue our ascent. We find TBRC members Mike Street and Paul Bowman manning the call blasting location. Daryl confirms that they too heard the crashing sound from a few minutes earlier, and they confer on what sounds is broadcast next. Both the speakers are oriented in the general direction of the crash, and the amplified sounds of agitated chimps fill the air over a valley in which they've never been. Daryl decides to take a more direct course of action. He tells me to turn on my red light, be quiet, and follow him over the side of the mountain. Daryl and I are currently going down a 45 degree incline from the area of call blasting towards the direction of our camp. After hearing what sounded like either a large stone or perhaps a tree, we suspect that that may have been some kind of threat display. We decided to actually cut across country down this hill in the direction of the sound. The thought of perhaps flushing something up. Did I mention that it's 11:45 at night? There's no moon. And we have dim red headlamps on our heads. It seems that I am either stupid or I trust Daryl. It seems to me that I will follow him into any damn thing.
We arrive at the valley floor without seeing any sign of what caused the boulder crash from earlier. It's late, and the team has the hardest part of their trip ahead of them tomorrow when they have to service the cameras upstream. As we lay in our bunks in the cabin's second-story loft, listening to the cacophony of insect and amphibian life outside filling the sultry air, we hear another boulder crashing into other rocks. Similar to the earlier incident, but possibly closer to the cabin. One of the team, sleeping on the porch in the bench swing, says he hears the sound several more times before daybreak. While I first introduced Operation Forest Vigil in Bibcast 5 this past July, the audio for that episode was actually recorded more than a year earlier in late June 2007. One of my objectives on this trip is to see for myself how their operation has evolved in the elapsed time. While servicing a camera aimed up a wide creek bed strewn with giant boulders and downed trees, project manager Chris Buttenbaugh fills me in on the current state of the operation.
So Chris, we're back out here servicing these cameras here, this time in Area X, and this is your camera number one. This is your first camera. You opened this up and had a little surprise, didn't you?
Yeah, it was full of termites. It's actually the third time this camera's been full of termites. I've actually moved it three different times, and they always find the camera. But I'm going to clean it out here for a while. I've always got it to work again, and I think I can make it work again.
You're taking your Leatherman there, and you're just scraping out all kinds of bug gunk from the inside of that camera case. So this is number one. This is the first camera that you guys put out?
Yeah, it was a little over 2 years ago, April, I believe, 2006. This is a still and a video camera, and it's captured some of the incredible bear images and videos. Lots of deer. We've actually got the first images here of a mother bear and 3 to 4 cubs that we've been able to see actually grow up into quite large bears now over the past couple of years.
In the setting we're in here, we're on a, well, what right now is a dry, rocky creek bed. This looks like a pretty natural avenue through the woods here.
Yeah, it's actually during the more rainier parts of the season, water will flow down through these side tributaries, I guess, or I'm not sure what the term is, but and they'll drain into a main river. But it brings a lot. There's actually an animal game trail right past here. Okay. That we've captured, you know, just animals over the past year. So we just always kept this camera here.
So one of the, this is an older camera, but one of the things that's changed the most in Operation Forest Vigil in the year since we were out with you last time was the quality of the cameras that you're using. What kind of cameras are you using now?
We're actually using the Reconyx RC60 cameras. They're only a still camera, but they have a rapid fire motion where they can fire over 10 images per event. These older cameras, these Cuddyback C3000s, capture a still image followed by a 1 minute video clip.
The reaction time on these, how does it, on this Cuddyback, how does that compare to the Reconyx?
The Reconyx is about a fifth of a second. I'd say the Cuddyback's more about a 15th.
Okay.
Not even, well, quite a 15th, but it's just, it doesn't even have the trigger speed of a, sure, of a Reconyx. I mean, an animal may walk into view and a third of the way through the picture, it finally takes a picture.
Right.
The Reconyx by then has already captured 4 or 5 images.
Right, so you might have a butt end of a deer versus 3 pictures of the deer.
Exactly.
Right. One of the things that I've noticed being out with you guys the past couple of days is that the Reconyx just take a whole lot of pictures.
Just thousands of images. Actually, one of the last cameras we checked had 5,100 images. The card was full. The batteries were actually dead. And it actually stopped taking pictures around May of this year, and now it's already the end of August, Labor Day weekend.
We're almost September here. But otherwise, some of the other cameras we're finding still have pretty healthy charges, even if they've been out here for months and months and months. And like you said, I think you put them out around the beginning of May, and here we are at the beginning of September, and they still got pretty good charges.
Yeah, most of them had, 75% power. There was one that was fully drained, and but they just... They're great cameras. They just go forever. They're really only dependent on how many pictures they take. The batteries will last forever if they don't, by the time they get the 5,000 pictures, they're pretty much at their end of their life. But we do have the capability, if we wanted to, we could put a larger card in there, and that would sustain the cameras for longer.
So the benefits of a camera that's better at conserving its power is that you don't have to come out here quite as often.
Exactly, and with the way the economy is now and the gas is, we need longer periods of travel.
Yeah.
Just not feasible to be able to come out every 2 to 3 months like before.
One of the things that we talked about last year, you were hoping to get those field media readers so that you could actually see the pictures without lugging a whole laptop out. You have those now. What do you think of them?
They've just been a great tool. I mean, we used to have to carry these large, expensive laptops into the field, and these little viewers, excuse me, I'm still getting ants away from the lid here. and all their wood feces, I guess. Pretty nasty. Yeah, they have about a 40 gig hard drive. They can just capture tons of images. So it's the best way for us to pull the card, offload it into the media viewer. We can actually sit there on the 4-inch screen and go through the pictures. But the downfall, I guess, with the Reconyx is because they shoot so many pictures, I believe we're going to have to end up going back to a laptop type screen, maybe a smaller, lighter weight type of a laptop that can give us a larger screen to view. Sorry, I'm watching a millipede or something crawl over there in the sun. Thought it was a snake for a minute.
So the what I've noticed on the Epson media readers is, first of all, the screen's very small. The thumbnails are literally the size of thumbnails, and they takes a while to chew through those pictures.
It does. That's the thing. I mean, we're in the field. We want to be able to go through the pictures quickly and really know what we capture, because if there was that magic shot in there, we don't want to be taking that card and erasing it.
Right.
I think we're probably the best thing we can do now is we'll stay with the Epsons. We'll go ahead and buy a second set of cards, so we can just start pulling the cards out of the camera, still offload them, but securely take those back out of the field with us, just in case we didn't go through the pictures as carefully as we should have.
Yeah, and it just seems that to me, the time at each camera seems longer this year than it was last year, and it just seems that you guys are going to need to be moving a little faster as you put more and more cameras in the field.
Right. With the more cameras we add, we need to get to the cameras quicker. The train already slows us down. Yeah. We need to be on top of these cameras, offload the cards, change the batteries, you know, put out any type of lures if need be quickly, and keep moving because, you know, daylight's always falling on us.
How many cameras do you have out in X now?
Right now we have 10 cameras. So I'd like to add possibly maybe 3 or 4 more. With these older cuttybacks, we've actually slowly over the past year and a half been slowly pulling them out of the field and replacing them with the faster Reconyx cameras.
So how many Reconyx do you have out here?
I have we have 6.
Okay, so 60%. I can do that math pretty easily.
Well, I'm sorry, actually 7 because we have 10. So we have 3 cuttybacks, 7 okay. Reconyxes.
Okay. So the plan is just as you obtain new cameras to swap out the old guys.
Right, and we actually, sometimes we actually will trade the cuttybacks in and get a newer version, okay. And then we will put that back in for investigations for people to learn on, or, you know, a sighting comes in that we need to get to quickly. Yeah. We don't have to worry about, oh, God, we only have 1 or 2 cameras. Right. We've got a fleet of cameras per region.
How much is one of these Reconyx cameras, the RC60s, how much does that cost?
I believe we pay around $550 to $600 for them. We try to buy them in lots that will keep the price lower on them. And what we say, we're able to buy the memory cards. Okay. I'm always looking at, you know, trying to save us money here and there to buy more equipment. And with our conference coming up here soon, that'll put more cash flow back into the equipment fund to purchase more cameras and other accessories we need.
So here we are. It's Labor Day weekend. When will you see this camera again?
Probably not till November, 1st of December. We may even have to wait, depending on our schedules, as late as January of 2009.
Yeah, it gets kind of tight there at the end of the year.
The bad thing with the cuttybacks is 3 months and they're gone. Right. And now that we're going to get into winter season here in a couple of months, they may most likely be dead by the middle of November. Okay. But with the Reconyx out here, we still have working cameras.
Well, I'll let you get back at this. Thanks for taking a second to talk to me.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks for coming out here with us.
My pleasure.
The next day, as the group was cleaning up and getting ready to head back to the real world, I sat down with Daryl on the porch of our cabin to explore the history of Area X's activity and the TBRC's objectives in the valley.
Daryl, why do you come to this place? Why this place for Area X?
Well, we come to Area X because, you know, like Area Y, there's just a long history of reported sightings, encounters here, and plus, you know, some of our own people have had their own observations here, and it also fits the habitat profile. This area gets a high amount of rainfall. It's extremely remote, very dense forestation. You know, it seems like a prime area. So, and that's, you know, that's why we come here.
The camera trap operation has been going for a few years now, but how long have you or people you're associated with in the TBRC been investigating this specific area?
Alton Higgins has been investigating this area for close to a decade now. In fact, he found a very clear trackway here back, I think it was 2000. So, you know, there you go. I mean, it's, what, 8 years? And, you know, just through the years we've had, you know, we've found tracks, team members have had experiences here. We've heard, you know, rocks, we've had rocks thrown at us. We've had cabins slapped, knocked in the middle of the night that, you know, really almost felt like they knocked us out of the bed. You know, they were so strong.
You have an interesting story from the first time that you came up here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, my first trip in here was 2004. My wife, Delinda, and my stepson Mikey and Alton Higgins came in here, and we had an extended stay. I think it was 5 days, 4 nights. I think it was in June of 04, and the weather was uncharacteristically cool. I remember the high was about 72, and at night it got down into the 50s. And you know, some things happened really over the span of like a day and a night, and that was pretty much it for that whole trip. But, you know, we had what we could only, assume were these hickory nuts that were being thrown at the cabin. And this went on all throughout the night, off and on. Every time we'd get up to go check it out, it would stop. And we'd go back to sleep, and we'd be reawakened later with these taps, these you know, something like being tossed against the side of the cabin. Well, finally, you know, we got up a couple times through the night. It would stop when we'd get up. We didn't have any night vision or anything like that with us at the time. It was almost supposed to be some sort of just a getaway vacation, you know, and it was pitch dark, couldn't really see anything. And finally, you know, at daybreak, we got up. I went outside to look, and there was just this huge pile of hickory nuts all along the side of the cabin where we had, you know, we'd heard the taps. The taps had been on the wall, the exterior wall between the bedroom that Delinda and I were staying in and the bedroom that Alton and Mikey were staying in. You know, I got up and I went outside and I saw the hickory nuts, and Delinda was still in the bedroom, and I picked up the hickory nut and I threw it on the roof of the cabin, and it just bing, and then you hear this rolling sound, and I could hear her inside, "That's not it." And so I picked up another hickory nut and I threw it against the side of the cabin on the wood, and she said, "That's it." And I threw another one. She said, "That's exactly it." I said, "Well," you know, I yelled inside, I said, "Well, y'all need to come see this." And so they all came outside, and they, you know, they saw the big pile of hickory nuts. And then later that day, you know, it was the day before. You know, I can't remember if it was the day before or that same or the next day. I was down the creek, and Delinda and Mikey were down the creek a little bit, but I was like 200 or 300 yards down the creek, and I heard this humongous rock, the impact sounds of a huge rock, and you know. Someone might say, "Oh, that, you know, it's a rock that got dislodged." Well, no, I mean, this was just, it was flat terrain through this area. And the sound was clearly a rock, a huge rock, hitting another group of rocks and then rolling or bouncing several times. And this was probably 40 to 50 yards from what would have been my right into the woods. Well, unbeknownst to me at that time, or perhaps a little bit before that, Delinda and Mikey had heard this strange sound that they described as like this in the woods. And, you know, and Delinda said it scared her. You know, she said she felt really spooked, and she got Mikey and said, we need to go. And so I guess about that, a little bit later, just like seconds later, half minute later, something's when I heard the big rock. And so I went back to the cabin, got Alton, and then Alton and I went, and we approached that sound, and we walked up the creek, and that's when we found the mossy tracks. The tracks going up the embankment of the creek with a very long step-to-step interval. And then we found one particular track on a rock that was covered in green, wet moss. Clearly see the toe indentations, and clearly a large track. And, you know, that was in 04, and... So that's just one example of things that have happened. We've had a number of things happen like that while we're in here.
What's interesting to me about the hickory nut story is that I've been over there, and there's an overhang on that roof. So you can't imagine that they'd be blown off a tree or anything, and you certainly can't imagine that they would only be blowing onto the side of the house and not onto the roof, and you can't imagine that they'd always hit the wood as opposed to the windows. What also, I believe the first time you told me that story, you were saying that they only were thrown while you were awake. You didn't hear them. I'm sorry, while you were asleep. You didn't hear them when you were awake. So when you were up, when Alton wasn't snoring, you didn't hear them. But when everyone settled back down, it started up again.
Well, I wouldn't say that while we were asleep. I would say that while we were in the bed and the lights were out. Right. Once we got up, we got out of bed, we turned the lights on, that's when it stopped.
Probably not the wind.
I clearly remember there was no wind. Because we asked all these questions ourselves.
Right. Right.
And as I recall, it was practically impossible for hickory nuts to be falling from any nearby trees. And I don't remember there being any branches overhanging there that would, you know. And even if there had been, the hickory nuts would have fallen and hit the roof and then rolled off. That was not what we were experiencing. Yeah. We were clearly experiencing something impacting the side of the cabin over an extended period of time intermittently, and it occurred only when we were in bed with the lights out,
quiet,
and had been quiet for a while. I mean, it's not like we just jumped in the bed, turned the lights out, and then it started again. Right. It wasn't like that. It, you know, in fact, we'd doze off to sleep, and then we'd be reawakened by this tapping sound. And the taps probably occurred every minute to 2 to 3 minutes. I mean, it wasn't like they were pop, 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 pop on the side of the cabin. It was like pop. And then Delinda and I would sit there and just, what is that? And then, you know, a couple minutes later, pop, you know. Now, you know, I don't remember hearing any secondary impact sound. Like, when you're standing outside and you toss the hickory nut, yep, you can hear the hickory nut hit the cabin, and then you hear this dull, very dull, and not very loud thud when it hits the ground. Perhaps we could not hear that from inside the cabin. And I don't remember Delinda saying anything about that, because when I did that, she said, that's it. And she yelled out to me, that was it. She said, that is the sound that we've been hearing.
Were the windows open or closed?
Oh, they were all closed.
Because it was cold.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was cool. It was cool. I mean, it was in the 50s. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to interrupt Daryl here for a second. I have to admit this hickory nut story fascinates me. The previous day, I went over to that cabin to assess the scene. I'm going to call it the East Cabin for clarity's sake, since it plays a role later in this podcast. First of all, there's a fence all the way around the East Cabin. It's closest to the cabin on its eastern edge, near the wall where Daryl heard the taps, but there's still at least 10 feet separating it from the cabin. Behind that fence is a rocky drainage coming down the mountain from the north and running into the creek bed to the south. At the time I'm there, there are no branches anywhere near the wall, and there's very little overhang. You can see pictures on the BigfootProject.org website. I found a few hickory nuts and tossed one at the wall in the area Daryl thought they were hitting it on that night. Then I tossed one up on the roof. Wall. Roof. Obviously, these are very different sounds. If there was nothing near the wall to bump into it, and no wind to blow anything onto it from at least 10 feet away, how was the sound made? And why did it only happen when the lights were out and the people inside were quiet? Assuming it was caused by the hickory nuts Daryl found on the ground the next morning, then grasping and throwing them would require a hand. Deciding to do it only when the people in the cabin were asleep or appeared to be would require some level of intellect. I'm very comfortable ruling out other people as the cause, since when the family's not present, there just aren't any around there. The drive down to this area is from the west, and it's over an hour on very inhospitable roads. There is no access from the east except for miles on foot or horseback. It's impossible to imagine someone sneaking up on this location undetected. So, if it's not people who threw the nuts, then what did? Okay, back to Daryl.
You've taken witness reports and counter reports from this general area, sort of like this larger area. Are there any that are particularly striking in your mind that stand out?
Oh yeah. One of the family members had a visual encounter right here, just above this particular cabin up on the top of one of the mountains that surrounds this little private tract of land.
Right. You say family members. There's a family that owns this land. They let you come in here and do this, and you're talking about one of those people.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a family here that's very accommodating and welcomes us in here. And they're the ones that brought us here because of the things they were experiencing. You know, rocks and then you know, family members having a visual and of vocalizations and. And so, yeah, the family is very cooperative, very accommodating, and every now and then, you know, we're in here probably 3 to 4 times a year. I think we've been here 3 times. The family has been here. They've always been very encouraging, yeah. And they welcome us in here, and they want us to do what we're doing here. So,
and one of the family members had an encounter on the land or very close to it.
Yeah, it's actually on their land. Apparently, their land goes up onto that mountain. They had a tree stand, a hunting tree stand up there. And this particular family member saw something in a tree that caught his peripheral vision. And when he turned to look, the way that he described it was that it was almost like a chimp. 4 feet tall, but it had a black face, and I think he saw it for 5 to 6 seconds, and then I think it disappeared into the dense foliage.
It was up in a tree?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he said it was up in the tree. And you know, that's, I wouldn't think that that's, I wouldn't classify that as uncharacteristic of, you know, what we think is Sasquatch behavior. I mean, there have been other reports like that as well, especially pertaining to, you know, what could be juvenile Sasquatches.
So we've been here 3 nights now. Besides working the camera traps, we've been doing some other operations at night. So how your take on the weekend, how do you think it went, and what are some of the more interesting tidbits from this weekend?
Well, the camera trapping went very well. I mean, these new Reconyx cameras that we're using, they're just phenomenal. They're just phenomenal. One of the cameras maxed out after 2 weeks, 5,000 photos. In 2 weeks' time, one of these cameras took 5,000 photos. And you contrast that with the older cuttybacks that we were using. And, you know, some of those cuttybacks have been out here 4 to 5 months without any maintenance and, you know, 15 photos, right, 20 photos. So, you know, and we're learning more every time we do these camera trap maintenance trips. We learn more about what we should be doing and what, you know, what seems to work. And one thing that we did learn is that the, you know, we did think that the bears were exclusively diurnal in here, but we've now got photographic evidence that they're, that, you know, that they do go nocturnal from time to time. We've got some really good bear shots, you know, at 2 a.m. in the morning. So so the camera trap maintenance went really well. It's always grueling because, you know, it's some very difficult terrain and you have to hike to these camera traps. But one thing we did as well was we attempted some nighttime research, some activities at night that were designed to elicit a response or contact with, you know, a possible Sasquatch if one were in the area, or if one were in, within earshot of what we were broadcasting. And we also came equipped with a whole assortment of new primate calls, from Siamangs to black howler monkeys to orangs to agitated chimps, long gorilla growls. I mean, we played just a whole litany of different sounds this time, and we absolutely got responses from the indigenous wildlife. Did we have a visual of a Sasquatch? No, we did not, but we had rocks thrown. Clearly rocks thrown. The second night, we absolutely called in what we think may have been a cougar, which it actually charged two in our party, but it was very low to the ground, and it didn't even seem to back off even when they white lighted it. They never could get a clear visual. And then we had Mike Street, who was way out in a very concealed blind. He had something approach the blind, and his dog Speck alerted to it, growled at it, and it stopped, it froze, according to what he said, and then it walked around him and went straight up the mountain. And earlier in the night, we heard what two of the observation teams described as whoops to the south, which would have been opposite the direction of where our call blaster was set up. He was set up on the mountain to the north, sort of on the downslope, and then the whoops came south of us. And, you know, they were much more faint than his blast, so it must have been a good ways out. So we definitely had some interesting activity, and the rock, what we interpreted as rock throwing, was absolutely intriguing because, I mean, to my way of thinking, there are only, you know, I mean, we know that humans can do that, but humans are limited absolutely by the size of the rocks.
Right. When you say rock throwing, I mean, some people imagine little pebbles being tossed at campers. This is like boulder tossing. I mean, what we heard was there's dry creek beds all around here, and that sounded like a pretty good-sized boulder getting chucked down the creek bed.
Yeah, I would say that the rock sounds we heard were at least the size of bricks, of large bricks, to the size of haydite blocks. That was the perception of what we all heard. And a couple of the family members, the owners of the land, were in one of the cabins. They confirmed that. In fact, they wanted to know if we had been knocking are throwing rocks. And, you know, of course not. No, we didn't do that. All we were doing, we were just playing the playbacks. And so we absolutely, you know, stimulated some response from some type of wildlife here. Unfortunately, you know, nighttime operations are very difficult, and you know, it's going to be very difficult to get any video or footage of anything at night, and we were not able to do that. But that's sort of a secondary goal for these nighttime ops. The nighttime ops really are designed to get something here, to pull something in where we have these camera trap arrays set up, so that after we leave, something is then in the area and maybe pays a visit to one of the camera traps. So that's really the whole premise behind the playbacks, the call blasting.
And as you were alluded to, even if that was just a cougar, that at least three different groups had experiences that may have been explained by one animal. That animal was drawn here by those calls, so they actually do bring animals in.
Absolutely, totally stimulates responses from wildlife. And we did mix in, during one of the playbacks, we mixed in a wild hog distress call. And we were playing distressed wild hog calls, and then the next was agitated chimps. And then we played some Siamang calls as well. And so if it was one animal or if it was the same animal, then, I mean, the bottom line is that it did generate a response. So, yeah, it works.
Thanks, Daryl.
You're welcome.
As I said in Bibcast 5, Daryl is a former Air Force intelligence analyst. That training, I'm sure, leads him to carefully divulge information on a need-to-know basis only. When he mentioned that what we think was a cougar charged two in our party, he chose not to say who those two were. In fact, I was one, and Monica Rollins was the other. Here's what happened. It's our last night in Area X, and we're back to call blasting. We are arrayed in three observation positions. Daryl and I are at the main cabin. Monica and Chris are in the middle position at the east cabin. And Mike Street is alone with his faithful dog Speck in a very well-concealed blind situated higher up the canyon near the creek bed to allow him, with his night vision gear, a clear line of sight up and down the creek. Paul Bowman mans the call blaster, which has been moved slightly down the mountain and directly above the east cabin, to concentrate the sound into the valley. After about an hour or so, we hear the whoops to which Daryl referred earlier. They came from the south near the opposite side of the canyon from Paul's position. After a little while, we decide to bring Monica and Chris back from the east cabin so she and I can walk the roads in the direction of the whoop-like sounds. However, upon returning to the main cabin, Monica reports hearing twice while sitting on the east cabin porch with Chris what she describes as a low, purring-like growling sound coming from the drainage on the other side of the cabin's fence. Also, soon after they leave, but before they arrive at our location, Paul radios us to tell us he's heard a crashing sound from the direction of the east cabin. We quickly decide to go back to investigate. Monica straps on Daryl's 357, and we head back. Even though I'm carrying the night vision gear, my thought is to shine my bright white flashlight into the drainage to see what I can see. The growling came from there, and it offers a natural avenue from the creek up the mountain and a nice place to hide below the grade of the surrounding land. We walk around the fence to the north of the cabin between it and the side of the mountain. Monica stays by the fence while I continue around the corner and look up and down the drainage, but I see nothing. We decide to start heading back when several things happen rather quickly. I hear rustling from behind. I turn and illuminate the source with my light. Monica turns after I do and sees with me the undergrowth just up the mountain, about 15 to 20 yards away, moving. I expect to see an animal leap out and run away, but instead, we both witness whatever's moving the brush is picking up speed and heading directly toward us in a straight line. We begin to back up, getting caught on thorny vines and tripped up by fallen branches. I suggest to Monica that now might be a good time to draw her weapon. At the very moment the animal in the bushes would have left the undergrowth and become visible, maybe 10 to 15 feet from me, it stops. We continue to move backwards around the corner of the fence with the intention of getting inside the fence. It's designed to keep out bears, so we're much safer in it than out. However, the gate is still many yards away. As we come around the corner and start moving down the western side of the fence, the animal appears to start heading away from us to the east. We can still see the foliage moving and hear rustling as it retreats toward Mike Street's position. As we approach the gate, we radio back to Daryl to report the encounter. Once inside the gate, I start sweeping the area with the night vision, trying to get a visual on the animal. Chris arrives shortly thereafter with a handheld thermal device and also conducts a 360-degree sweep of the area. We never see the animal, and it does not return. As mentioned by Daryl, shortly after our encounter, Mike Street's location was approached from the direction of the east cabin, which was behind him. Whatever it was got very close to his blind, but he could not get around to see it since he was positioned to look up the creek. Speck's growl stops it dead in its tracks, and Mike can hear it moving very slowly and quietly away from the blind. When it reaches the slope, he hears it tear off up the mountain at great speed, making quite a commotion. Thinking about it later, Mike reports that the animal he heard approach him from behind sounded large and bipedal. While he cannot say what it was, running uphill from a threat is an unusual animal behavior. A short while later, Paul reports over the radio that he's heard growling at the call blasting location. He hears it clearly, but cannot see through his night vision where it's coming from. Upon hearing his description of the growl the next day, it's clear to Monica that they heard the same thing. It's important to say that Monica and I do not believe our animal encounter was squatchy in nature, unless it was one of the very rare North American pygmy variety of Sasquatch. I cannot say if Mike's encounter was with the same animal, but it seems clear that Paul's was. As Daryl mentioned, our best guess is cougar, though few animals will charge two adults shining bright lights at night, even predators. My takeaway from this encounter is that you're never really safe in the woods. People who don't often go out into the field, I think, might feel an unwarranted sense of security when surrounded by modern technology like flashlights, night vision, or even sidearms. The bottom line is, when you're in the woods, even if you're armed and can see into the dark, you're just another animal. A very small dot on a very large expanse of green. What's more, you're on their turf. They can hide, blend in, and surprise you at the very moment you least expect it. I have to admit, I felt pretty safe at the moment Monica and I were charged. The light, the gun, the safety in numbers. I really can't say if the animal we encountered meant to harm us or if it was even capable of doing so, but if it was, and if it wanted to, it could have, especially if I had been alone. If you go into the field, make sure you know the potential threats and are prepared to deal with them if and when they arise. While the TBRC did not capture any images of hairy bipedal animals on their camera traps, the trip was still measured a success. It's absolutely clear that blasting animal calls attracts and elicits responses from wildlife. In addition, the use of sounds made by various primates like orangutans, gorillas, and chimps seems to incite possible boulder tossing, not heard in the area since 2004. In fact, our trip was the only time that sound had been heard more than once. The experience of our weekend there, when combined with the activity observed in the past, from trackways to cabins being struck in the middle of the night, to unidentified animal calls, not to mention the direct sightings by various family members over the years, suggests the TBRC's interest in the area is well warranted, and, even after a decade of investigation, Area X has yet to reveal its secrets. I sincerely hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bigfoot Information Project podcast. I appreciate all the support of my listeners out there and hope you'll stop by the Bigfoot Information Project website at bigfootproject.org for a special bonus download from this show. And don't forget to check out the Bigfoot forums at bigfootforums.com to leave feedback on this and all previous Bibcast episodes. If you're a subscriber to the Bibcast via iTunes, I'd appreciate it if you could take a moment and rate or review the show there. If you're like most people I've heard from and dislike waiting for new Bibcasts, then check out another podcast I produce with Scott Harriet and Paul Vella called The Bigfoot Show. It's a more informal, conversational, and hopefully humorous look at the world of Sasquatchery. You can find out more about it at thebigfootshow.com or subscribe via iTunes. I'd like to thank Daryl Collier, whose name I can now pronounce, for his enthusiasm and terrific leadership over the course of the weekend I spent in Area X. I'd also like to thank Chris Buttonbaugh, whose name I'm pretty sure I'm still mispronouncing, for keeping all those cameras clicking out there. In addition, I have to thank Monica Rollins, not only for being armed on our last night in X, but for her ability to stay calm in the face of the unknown, and for helping to keep me from running off into the night like a little girl. Until next time, this is Brian Brown, and I'll see you out there. Everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who
knows where it's at. Tell me everybody's picking up on that feline beat. Cause everything else is obsolete.
Strict high-button shoes.
A square with a horn makes you wish you weren't born.
Every time he plays.
But with a square in the act, you can set music back
to the caveman days.
I've heard some corny birds who tried to sing.
Still, the cat's the only cat who knows how to swing.
Oh, that's the dick, long head dick, stuff like that. When everybody wants to be a cat, a square with a horn makes you wish you weren't born.
What's interesting about the hickory nut